My guest for this year's Valentine's special is one of the most innovative, radical and compelling writers at work today, Mina Kandasamy. I came to Mina's work through her formerly groundbreaking novels, The Gypsy Goddess and When I Hit You, but she began her career as a poet, and she returns to poetry with her latest publication, The Book of Desire, a new translation of the third part of the Tirukkural, the foundational poem of Tamil culture. In all of its 2,000-year history, this song of love, desire, yearning, and all that goes along with it has only once before been translated into English by a woman. With her new translation, Kandasamy offers what she calls a feminist interventionist translation. Since this is the first and only translation of this great poem I have read, I can't really speak to how it compares to previous versions, but I can say that it feels fresh, lively, and sensual, as if the feelings it describes have been experienced not 2 millennia ago, but on this very day, which in a very real sense they have, and which I suppose is very much the point. Alongside her wonderful translation, Kandasamy has also written a fascinating, pugnacious introduction, providing readers a history of the poem, both public and personal, as well as an accessible primer to the translator's art, its pitfalls and its rewards. Mina Kandasamy's translation of The Book of Desire is a genuine marvel, and I'm thrilled to say she joins us to discuss it. Mina, welcome to the Shakespeare & Company podcast.
Hi, Adam. Thank you for having me with you today.
It's a delight to have you here, if only remotely. Before we dive into the poetry of this book, I'd like to talk a little bit about your history with this particular poem. So you begin the book dedicated to Appa, Dr. Kandasamy, and you write, "One summer vacation in my teenage years, you made me read and learn by rote every single kural. I never realized it then, but that changed everything." Could you tell us a little bit about how that changed everything?
So I think I'll actually start with the fact that the book is dedicated to my father. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's a book about lovers. Mm-hmm. And technically, ideally, in a easier world, in a more tolerant world, it should have been dedicated to one of my lovers. But what happened here is that all my lovers were either non-Tamil or they happened to be spineless. as in the Tamil men wouldn't want to own up to being with me or having been with me at any point in time. And I didn't feel comfortable enough dedicating it to a guy who is not Tamil, who would not access the same text in the same way, which is why, hence the translation. So I felt, the only victim of, you know, my dedication could be my father, because he introduced me to this text. Mm-hmm. And yeah, for me, like at that age, it was like, you know, I went into the text really reluctantly, I must say, because I kind of saw that as a moment where my father was like, you know, this is our culture and I really don't want you to miss it and you really have to learn. And there's a very special way in which it's learned by little children. In that they learn everything by rote. So if there are 1,330 kurals that make up the larger poem of the Tirukkural, then you learn everything and you actually know the number and then the corresponding kural. So you become like a little parrot. And for my father, I think it was part of his guilt because, you know, I went to a state subsidized school, which was very close to my house, but it happened to be a federal school. So I learned only Hindi and English and not my own mother tongue. So my father realized that at some point I have to learn my mother tongue to be Tamil enough, you know, to have this connect, because he's a Tamil scholar. So I learned the Tirukkural and, you know, huge resistance, of course, but still this was my dad. He was very strict. He was a disciplinarian. But at some point, I think that's, you know, I think especially the love poems, I really started realizing that this is a very beautiful world, even if it was like, you know, coming through to me through my parents or coming through to me through the broader culture. And, you know, at the time, I really didn't realize that, you know, it's going to play such a massive role in my own life. So for me, I must be thankful to my father. You know, you could have, that is also an age where, you know, a lot of parents would push you like, oh, do another extra hour of math or do an extra hour of science. You know, like become a sports person, get better at chess and, you know, win a title or, you know, do well in math and become an engineer. But my dad was like, you know, read love poetry.
Yeah. I'm probably bringing kind of quite a lot of my sort of repressed English kind of Victorian hangover kind of attitude to this. But it seems kind of unusual, I guess, from an English perspective, that to have such sensual poetry, because that's what it is. Like, it's not, you know, it's declarations of love, but it's very it's not, at least in your translation, it's not steeped in euphemism or anything like that. And I'm just curious about that as sort of something given to sort of children and teenagers to read. Is that something that sort of separates, I know you've lived in the UK, like that separates sort of, let's say, English and Tamil culture, that Tamil people would be more comfortable with that level of sensuality?
It's again very interesting, Adam. The thing is, there's two aspects to this. So coming back again to my father, like absolutely, like we grew up in a house without television, without radio, without, never having gone to the cinema until I was an adult myself. So I don't think the idea was to, you know, be liberated or liberal in any sense. We had very strict parenting, no going out of the house in the evenings without a chaperone. So it's all of these very, really, really strict upbringing. But the thing is, the Thirukkural is thought, but often the love poetry is not thought. Like very recently, last year, a Tamil judge was listening to a petition saying this should be mandatory and made compulsory in schools, and he agreed with it. And he said, okay, make it mandatory, but don't teach the section on love, because, you know, mm-hmm. that is inappropriate for young people. So there is that. But on the other hand, nobody says don't read it, because one is that I think... you know, like I used to read that, and when I was that young, like 13 or 14, I really used to think of some of my mom's and my father's love for each other in these mm-hmm. poems, because, you know, my mom was a very possessive person. So I would read this and actually empathize with my father. There's things like, you know, this guy says, you know, I was just thinking of you. And then she starts crying like, oh, but when did you stop thinking of me? Or he says that I love you more than all. And then she says, mm-hmm. then whom? Like, you know. The fact that he just says he loves her triggers her. So I'm like, oh my God, this is exactly my mom, you know? You know? So in a sense, like, even if you're really a child, like, you don't have to, you could project that to any kind of love, even, you know, very sanctioned matrimonial love. So I don't think there is that level of repression in Tamil culture. Mm-hmm. And on the other hand, it's also true that, you know, it doesn't mean that... you know, parents and children are discussing sex at the dinner table.
Right.
so we have to understand this whole thing with moderation. Mm-hmm. But also, a lot of people do think that, I think it was very specific, because my father had this arts background. Like, you know, he would ask me, oh, you should read Shakespeare, you should read, you know, and I was reading mm-hmm. Romeo and Juliet, and, you know, so people are like, oh, it doesn't matter. Like, you know, mm-hmm. I don't think they would like to stifle you in that way. So mm-hmm. There's obviously, so it's true. But the book itself has suffered from, I think, a longer history of, you know, being translated by, let's say, either Victorian, you know, people who are here, like, you know, officers of the British government, mm-hmm. or let's say even by the early Jesuits. For instance, there's a Jesuit priest called Veera Mamunivar who does mm-hmm. the original first translation, and his book is too radical for him, like it's too dirty for him, so he does the first two parts and he leaves the third part. Uh-huh. And so that's the how it goes. So this is actually one of my favorite portions of the text. The subtleties of sulking. And my most favorite, of course, comes right at the top. This is the Kural that we, let's say, is numbered 1311. And in Tamil, it goes like this. Penniyalar yellarum kannin podu unbar nannen paratthu nin marbu. And so she's basically telling him, I'm reading the translation, everyone with womanness publicly feast their eyes, but I will not embrace your debauched chest. And I'm going to read the rest of the chapters, the rest of the Kurals in this chapter. We sat, we sulked, and we said nothing. He sneezed, knowing well that we would break our silence. We would bless him, saying, long live. This is in the man's voice. I wear flowers fresh off trees. She burns. You wear this only to show off to some woman. When I said I loved her more than anyone else, she sulked, asking, then whom? I said, in this birth, we're inseparable. Tears welled up in her eyes. I remembered you, I said. So that means you had forgotten me, she cried, and pulled herself away from embracing me. I sneezed, she blessed. Then, erasing her blessings, she wept. Which woman now thought of you, causing your sneeze? I suppressed my sneeze. She cried, are you hiding from me that your woman is thinking of you? I pacify her. She burns. Is this how you do it with the others as well? I long for her. I gaze at her. She burns. Who is that woman on your mind as you take in every part of me?
Well, let's talk a little bit about the history of the poem and indeed the poet. So you go into this quite a lot during the introduction, and I'm not going to make you retread all of that now. But one thing that was really fascinating to me while reading this was that how the Tamil civilization seems to be shaped and defined by this particular poet. I mean, you mentioned Shakespeare a moment ago, and perhaps in a sense, even more so, we get the impression, even more so that Shakespeare's influence on English and the English language and English culture. This poet, is it Tiruvalluva? Seems to have kind of really been foundational in not just Tamil literature, but Tamil civilization generally.
Yes, it is true. I think part of his appeal is because of the format in which he renders what he says. So it's become accessible, has this unbroken history of, 2,000 years, but also the message. So it's hugely secular. Like there is literally no specific God, no specific religion. There is and operating in the Indian subcontinent, the foundational text for, let's say, Hinduism or the foundational text for a lot of the other classical language, Sanskrit, would be the Vedas. And a lot of them are actually founded on the basis of inequality, on the basis of superiority of birth. And on the other hand, this Kural is, it can be about so many things, but the moment of its subversion and the moment at which the Tamil identity seeps, it both holds a mirror to Tamil society, but also holds a lesson to Tamil society. It says, Pirapokkum yella uyirkum sirappava seidol vetrumayan, which means all beings are the same in birth. And that's where it starts, that you are all equal. And I think it's very important for Tamils to actually construct ourselves that way, that, all of us are equal, all of us are Tamil. So that's where we start. That's the basic understanding. But there's also so many ways in which this text, for me, this is a text that, you claim and you reclaim and you claim and you reclaim. And that's how... and for me, I could have just translated the poetry and left it there. And, the introduction for me was like 48 long pages. And I'm like, should I do this? Should I not do this? Because once I stopped writing, I couldn't stop. Because, and many of these questions actually were answered because Sam from Galley Beggars asked me, how did this text survive? And I'm like, so how did it actually survive? But it was not a given that this text should have survived. Like there was this culture, it was surviving on palm leaf manuscripts, but there were times when the imposing culture, the hegemonic culture was actually making people drown these manuscripts or throw them in the fire. So it managed to survive that. How did it survive when there's an onslaught? How does it survive all of this? So I think this text is really foundational. And the thing is, it's still relevant today. Like, just like 2 or 3 days ago, they had released this photograph of Valluvar, and for some reason they had put, dressed him in saffron clothes, and they had put this, the Hindu mark of, sacred ash on his head. And there was immediate revolt from a lot of people, like, why are you trying to saffronize him? Why are you trying to Hinduize him? He doesn't stand for any particular religion. And it's very important because, that's how it's so fun. Like, Tamils can be Hindus, Tamil can be Christians, Tamil can be Muslim, but you don't, to be a Tamil, you don't need a religious identity. And so it's not like French secularism, but different type of secularism in which we are like, we are fine with everything. We don't want to be identified with any of it, but we are deeply respectful towards all of it. So think, so it's a very fascinating text. I think the other favorite one is, this one where it's called in Tamil, Nenjodu Pulattal. So it's basically like a soliloquy, but she's just fighting with her own heart. So in English, I've translated this as berating her heart. I'll read the first Kural in Tamil again, just to give you a taste of the language. This is Kural number 1291. Avar Nenje, Avar Kadal Kandum, Yevan Nenje, Niyama Kagadadu. And in English, it goes, having seen how his heart is in love with him, dear heart, whose are you when you don't get along with me? And then I'm going to keep reading the rest of the 9 chorals. Having seen he cannot come close or commit, my heart takes no offense. It still goes in search of him. It is said the ruined have no friends. Is that why, my heart, you abandon me and run after him? First sulk and refuse, then yield and enjoy. You failed to follow this. Who will now rally around you, my heart? The fear of not attaining my lover, and after having him, the fear of separation. My heart lives in this perpetual agony. I think this is really beautiful in Tamil, so I'm just going to read the Tamil here. Peramai anjum, perin pirivu anjum, ara idumbai tennanju. It's like this is a wound that just doesn't heal. And this is, as I translated, perpetual agony. And then this a little more. Alone, I remained thinking of him as my heart kept devouring me. Under the influence of my shameless, foolish heart, I forgot all bashfulness, but I could not forget him. Caught in the love of its life, my heart recollects his greatness alone, because blaming him brings disgrace upon it. Whoever will be my companion in grief when my own heart refuses to stay with me? Again, the Tamil in this is really beautiful. This is 1299. Thunbathirku yare thunayavar, thamudaiya nenju thunayal vazhi. And then the last one in this chapter. My own heart is not my ally. Will strangers send their own heart my way?
I want to come on to the politics of the translation in a minute, but just resting with the language at the moment, you write in the introduction that Tamil is one of the world's oldest surviving languages, and indeed the oldest classical language still in use. And just as to help those of us who are not familiar with Tamil understand, when you read the chorals in Tamil, is it essentially the same language that would be spoken today? Or is it sort of, again, to make that comparison with Shakespeare, is it that sense of like you feel its age, but it's still fundamentally the same language?
So kadal is the Tamil word for love. It's still same 2000 years ago. Kamam is the Tamil word for desire, for sex is the same. Malar is the same word for flower, is still the same. Kan, the eyes are the same word, you know. So I could just read like randomly. Malaranna kannal aruma eriyadu alaremakku. So, you know, she says, unaware of the worth of my flower-eyed beloved, this village gifted me poisonous gossip, and malar is Tamil, eye is Tamil, arumai is speciality or worth, it's Tamil, ariyadu does not know, that's Tamil, like I use it every day. Mm-hmm. You know, alar is possibly not so frequently used, the word for gossip, but mm-hmm. you understand immediately what it is. Indadu is, you know, basically the mother giving birth to the child. So that's the birthing of something. So she says, this Ivur, again, this village, it birthed this gossip, not knowing her worth. So literally all of this, like, you know, is in the same Tamil. So of course there are words that are archaic, and it's very important for a language to have archaic words to show that, you know, these words fall out of use. But I think at the heart of it, it's still the same language. At least the word for love hasn't changed. The word for gossip hasn't changed. The word for man and woman hasn't changed. So it's a lot of the word, I think, roughly, I'm very bad with statistics, but I would say about 60 to 65% all the words I use today. And 25%, if you are like a little bit advanced learner of the language, you would know there are very, very few words that, you know, we are absolutely not aware of or something.
Yeah. So let's talk about your translation project. So again, near the beginning, you write, I realize that I have been translating this Tamil universe since long before I conceived of it as a literary political project. And we get the sense that this is, you know, at least a decade or more in the making. So did you begin this as a sort of a personal project, or was it sort of, did it just grow sort of organically through your sort of relationship between the different languages that you speak?
No, I don't think I had like any grand intention that I should translate this, even though I have to say that at various points I've been disappointed by what I've seen, because it just didn't bring out all the layers and all the complexity and all the meanings. But sometimes, you know, there are things that you would like to share, but, you know, like, for instance, my partner at the moment, he doesn't speak Tamil, and then, you know, I would like to, you know, translate this to him. So, and it just, it doesn't become like easy to translate. So, you know, you're doing the translation yourself. So I think that's where I said that, you know, I've been translating this culture without thinking of this as a project of translation, because, you know, like, if you're loving somebody from another culture, you're trying to say, like, for instance, there's a lot of these poems about trying to pick a fight, like having to, but the fight is a pretense to, you know, patch up and then make love. So the fight is a pretense of, you know, to seek validation, but also to show interest, because if you don't fight, where's the interest? Like, where's the tension? There's all of this, right? So, and it's not, you know, fight, but still like a certain kind of dramatic tension there. So, and it's, this is really cultural, and sometimes you have to unpack your culture to somebody else, like, oh, you know, this is not, and then you just, if I just say that, you know, trying to provoke you into a small little fight, it's just the way I like to keep you engaged, people are not going to believe you. So you sometimes have to go to this poem and say, you know, it's part of my culture, and then you'll I just kind of have to get the revolver to bail me out of the situations I get into. So it's like, oh, this is being Tamil, so, you know, now I don't have to feel apologetic. Now I have a book I can place in people's hands and say, oh, this is the Tamil people's love. But yeah, so it's been there for a long time. But also, even with my own, even with my Tamil lovers, I felt, you know, often the need to go into this text, like the place where it just goes like, how lovers can look at each other as if they're absolute strangers, and only they can look at each other. And sometimes you really do feel that, you know, not all love is public, not all love is acknowledged, not all love ends up in a marriage. So sometimes you're the side chick. So then you have to leave this love as well, isn't it? So yeah, so you do keep going back to this text because, as you said, it's so fresh. It's so relevant to today. So yeah.
And you say that you see translation as a radical and transformative act of political intervention. Is that because, in a way, it sort of, it allows the kind of concretization to an extent of a reading that you might have of it? So when it's in Tamil, there's sort of the, you know, having your reading of it be given flesh in a way isn't sort of, isn't really possible because it's in the original language. But once you transpose it into English, it allows you to own it and to interpret it perhaps more than it would in left in the original.
No, I think it's quite interesting. Why I would, the reason it's feminist is because, you know, there's so much of this text in which there is female desire, and it's throbbing through the whole text. Like, it's true, you know, often you only deal with male desire, which objectifies women, and there's a bit of that, you know, there's a beautiful woman and it goes on about that. But there's also a lot of, you know, this way, like this one, everyone talks about it, or, you know, they've quoted this often in the reviews. For instance, I read the English here. I swim the rough seas of sexual desire. I see no shore. So in Tamil, it is Kama Kadambunal Neendi Karai Kaanen Yamattam Yane Ulen. So, and this is all a woman trying to talk about what is happening with her. And she's talking openly about the rough seas, like Kadambunal, Kama Kadambunal, the rough seas of sexual desire. And, you know, and it's amazing that, you know, when you actually translate this text, like, it's of course true that it exists in the Tamil world, but, you know, when you bring it into this world, you also change how the Tamil woman is looked at, you know, not as a passive person, not as a passive object. And to kind of take the space that exists in your own culture, in your own civilization, and to say, this is who we are, you know, because one, there's so much, you know, like later a part of Tamil culture became so influenced and so, you know, both by British colonialism, but also by, you know, North Indian, you know, other caste codes and stuff, which means that, you know, women were praised for being very shameful and bashful. And this is a text that's like, oh no, we're not bashful. So in all of these aspects, you know, rescuing the text, or in so many ways, bringing out the absolute shameless or powerful women into it, who are like, you know, making love, or, you know, thinking of love, talking about their desire, and feeling like totally fine with it. I think it's very important for me. Like, that's what I think it it's feminist, but also interventionist for me, because, you know, how do you present this text instead of, you know, hiding it? So it was a lot of this, of course, but I forgot your original question. So, this is something nice. It's called Nirai Arithal, and Nirai in Tamil is often translated as chastity everywhere, but Nirai actually just basically means fullness, and fullness as in being in control of yourself. So Nirai Arithal is the destruction of Nirai, or a lament for lost self-control. So the battle axe of passion breaks down the door of my unwavering mind, bolted with my coyness. And then she says, what goes by the name of love is blind, is unkind, and runs the business of controlling my heart even at midnight. I try and conceal this lust of mine. With no intimation, it materializes like a sneeze. I am perfect. I have such self-control, I would say, but my hidden away lust betrays me, proclaiming itself publicly. Those suffering from lovesickness shall never know the magnanimity of not running behind those who now hate us.
But picking up on what you said, one thing I found really interesting and very kind of subversive about your translation as well is that, because of course it is, as you say, it's a poem written by a man, and you are translating it into essentially what is a kind of colonialist language as well. And yet the result is something that feels incredibly, yeah, incredibly fresh and incredibly kind of reclaimed, and as you say, with a real kind of sort of feminist edge to it. And I was wondering if you could just reflect for a bit on that sort of, that subversive nature of using these elements of, you know, poetry by a man and putting it into a language which could be considered a colonial language, and yet producing something which feels radical and subversive.
So the first question is, it is poetry by a man, but then you have to look at how does this man look at women, you know? So I think right at the beginning, he talks about Pandariyen Kutri and Badanai Ini Arindhen Pendagayal Peramarkatra. Like, in those times, I did not know what is death. And now I've looked at this woman's eyes and I know what it is like. And he's constantly calling her like a goddess, but also she has a shock troop of, you know, terrifying women around her. She's powerful, her eyes are piercing, and it's always about battle. And so the woman is very strong. And so he's not a guy who is like, you know, I saw her in the kitchen and, you know, she was cooking me this meal. And he's not like, you know, she's... I think it's a text that celebrates both the fact that she's gentle and the fact that she's strong. And for me, I don't think there was any essentialization or any type of, you know, subjugation of the women, because obviously if the text was subjugating women, I wouldn't choose it. That would be a no-go for me. And it's very interesting because Thiruvalluvar is somebody, this is of course the love poetry, but I know that elsewhere, in a very important chapter, I think it's very early on, it's about family life and the wife, and he says something which, you know, struck a chord with me, and I write about it elsewhere. He says, what's the point of guarding somebody's chastity or honor, or whatever you call it, you know? He says, and he doesn't even use any of these words. He says, Sirekakum kapu yevan seyum. So what is the point of guarding someone like a prison? And the second line goes like, Magalir nirekakum kape thalai. So the real safety is what women do with themselves, what a girl does with herself. And I think that's the thing, like, it's a woman's choice, like, how she decides and how she perceives herself. And I think it's really radical. It basically says it's none of your business. Like, she can take care of herself, and that's the that's the most best way of her taking care of herself. Like, for me, that's the most powerful text. Like, it tells anybody not to impose anything. Like, a woman knows her way. And I think for me, that autonomy that this text gives to women, that it gives to the expression of love, all of this is so important. So the fact that, and sometimes, you know, like, of course, Valluvar lived, there's no questioning that. But, you know, the fact that he's, I'm not going to hold the fact that he's a man against him. it's like with Shakespeare, you know, I'm not going to hold his accident of birth against him. The fact that, oh, he was white, he was British or English, and he was a man. But no, I can appreciate good poetry where it comes from. And then the second thing, again, in terms of English as a colonial language, it could possibly be seen that way. But I don't know if... I think so much depends on how you use this language. For me, English is, you know, for instance, for Tamil people around the world, or Tamil people in India, Hindi is far more colonial than English because Hindi is a language whose imposition we resist. And English is something that for us is a global language. It's the language you have to use in order to be understood, in order to, you know, it doesn't erase what we are. Like I could write in English and still be the most Tamil person I know. So for me, I don't think the language itself was a problem. And so I do think that one thing that I was afraid of is that I think Tamil people are very dramatic. And my idea was that the English are kind of restrained. So how do I bring this drama? They're like, you know, there's really too much drama. So, but I do think that, you know, I tried to do what I could do without being cheesy, because that's the whole thing. Like sometimes the big fear is that you could say, like, that's the thing with English. It's not the fact that it's colonial, but because it's the language of the global market, anything you say could become cheesy, could become hallmark. And that's the connection between capitalism and English as opposed to, you know, even the colonial history in English. And so how do you do that? How do you make it such a personal thing that this woman is talking about this man as opposed to something somebody could write on a card?
Yeah. It's that challenge, isn't it? I remember talking with a Chinese person about the way that Chinese films are often subtitles and in English. And it just feels like, essentially, like a lot of the time, the Chinese people speak in aphorisms the entire time. And I remember this friend saying, yeah, this would be a kind of a literal translation. But of course, when it's your mother tongue, it doesn't feel like an aphorism. It feels very natural. And that was going to bring me on to my next question, is some of the challenges of translation. Because, you know, I've translated quite a bit from French to English. And even between these two languages, which are, you know, comparatively very close, there's so many decisions that have to be made, both artistic decisions, political decisions, aesthetic decisions, in going from one language to another. So would you be able to talk about some of the challenges that you faced bringing this love poetry into a very different language?
No, I think it's, yes, of course, there's some aspects of it, but largely, as you said, you know, like Chinese English or French English, like these are specific language combinations. So one of those things is that predating Thiruvalluvar, we had Tolkapiyar, who wrote the first definitive grammar of the Tamil language, and it's the ancient, most ancient extant Tamil grammar, so it's still alive today. And one of those things that he codifies, or basically he observes the previous poems and then he, you know, draws his connections from that, is about the landscape in Tamil poetry and how each landscape corresponds to a certain mood. So often, you know, mountains is where the first encounter takes place between the lovers. And so every landscape, something is about parting. The sea is often about parting, and, you know, the desert is about separation. So, you know, I will go into this in another podcast. But also each time of day is about a certain emotion. So evening is about the pain of separation and waiting for the lover, not knowing they're coming home. So there's a lot of these poems, like, you know, about she says evening is like killing her. And I was afraid, like, what it's like a shorthand, right? So because the way the environment is classified like this, and because birds and animals are classified, because the time of the day is classified and the seasons are classified. So each of these belong. So it's a Tamil shorthand, like, you know, you're talking either about the first meeting, you're talking about the parting, you're talking about a lover's quarrel, or you're talking about missing them. So, you know, everything evokes something. But obviously a reader who's not Tamil or not a Tamil scholar, because I don't think it's a common knowledge for Tamil people at this point, but at least for Tamil scholars and Tamil writers, this is a shorthand that exists for them. And how does somebody else get this shorthand? They don't, right? But then the beauty of the poem is that you don't necessarily have to know all of this, but at the same time, it's like an invitation like, you know, at some points you can learn and you can discern more about it. Okay, this is something that's nice. It's called The Lament of the Lovesick. This is basically the woman, you know, talking about how she feels because the man has left her. So it's not just the fact that she misses him, but also she misses the lovemaking. So in Tamil, it's called Padarmelin Dirangal. That the fact is that, you know, she's suffering from lovesickness. And so here it goes. I would, if only I could, hide this lovesickness. If someone draws, it surges forth like a gushing spring. No, I cannot conceal it. No, I cannot explain this disease to the man who causes it. It's shameful. My life is torn between lust and shame, and this my frail body cannot bear. My desire is an endless sea. There is no raft to swim across safely. What would be the fate of his enemies, I wonder, when he unleashes so much suffering towards his friends? Sex, its pleasure, a wordless word, a sea, its path leading to a pain even more immense. I swim the rough seas of sexual desire. I see no shore. In the dead of night, I am alone. She lulls all life on this land to sleep. Kindest night, she has no one but me to keep her company. Crueler than my cruel one's atrocities are these late night hours dragging on painfully. If, like my heart, these eyes too could travel the inner way, they would not have to swim in such flooded waters.
And this actually brings me on to, I think, what we'll finish on today is that we've talked a lot about the context, the language and things like that, but we haven't talked a great deal about the content. And one thing that really struck me was both the kind of the specificity of it to, you know, the Tamil people and the vision of Tamil women, but also the universality of it. And so there are moments when I almost felt like I could have been reading Roland Barthes in like A Lover's Discourse. There was this kind of, and I don't know, is that down to the universality, do you think, of love as a human sensation?
Actually, for me, I remember reading Barthes sometime in my 20s. Some lover sent this book to me and said, read this. And strangely, I opened this page on jealousy. Uh-huh. And for the first time, actually, it was very surprising for me because somebody was acknowledging jealousy. Mm-hmm. Because a lot of, I think, English literature, it's seen as a very negative emotion. It's seen as a very, as an emotion that's, you know, possibly ends up in duels or something. But, you know, it's something that nice people don't have. But, you know, jealousy is so much like at the heart of Tamil love, like at least in the Thirukkural, like there's all of this tension around it. Mostly playful, but it does exist. And for me, then actually, when I read part, I realized, oh, this is somebody else who's normalizing jealousy. Like, oh, well, there's a Tamil guy in, you know, in French land. So I realized that. So I do think that, you know, that's a very beautiful comparison because of the way in which it's very fragmentary, and you anybody could sink into it, and anybody could take something out of it. But also this whole thing about the lover is the one who waits. Because so much of this is about waiting, and you know, wait, she's talking about how time passes when she's waiting, and how it's so slow, and how she cannot tolerate the nights, and how the evenings are so melancholic, and you know, and then she said, and she also talks about how she keeps herself alive during the waiting, like, you know, by thinking about him constantly, and then also berating the fact that he left her alone. So what kind of a guy could leave her alone? And commenting on the people around, like, you know, what are these talking about him, they all say he's abandoned me now. So, you know, it's amazing, you know, the way you just go into it. So I think it's really universal. And that's the beauty. Like, how did somebody make something that is so relevant to us, like so many years later, and just connect with it? You can absolutely connect with it. So, yeah, I think it's a beautiful text.
Yeah. And I think concerning the sort of, let's say, message of the text as well, it feels kind of incredibly, I think you even use these words in the introduction, like incredibly democratic in some way compared to, let's say, a lot of maybe more historical texts on the relationships between between lovers, between men and women, that it's sort of, it has, seems to be something which, yes, speaks to our times across the centuries in a way that I think is quite rare for texts of this age.
Yes, you're right. I'm going to agree with you. Yeah, that's what I feel. That's what I feel as well. Like, it's there's something about the total vulnerability of the man and the woman, in that moment of love, like, you know, and there's something so absolutely strong about them together, and they're absolute equals because, you know. And I think the text really harnesses that, which is also why I always think that, you know, for someone like Valluvar, so he wrote 1,330 Kurals, which become 133 chapters, and it's only the last 25, which is about love, and the rest of them, the first 108, are obviously about, you know, governance and how a king should be and how a spy should be and how a minister should be and how a knowledge seeker should be and how a farmer should be or whatever it is. All of this, you know, statecraft that he wrote about, or what he wrote about virtue and the praise of rain, or, you know, how you respect the environment, whatever it is that he wrote about. And I'm like, why did he have to write about love? He could have just written the philosophy and stopped there. But I always think that he wrote about love because I think love is this entry point to democracy. Love is this entry point in which you realize that, you know, the world is an equal place, that you have to create something that's beautiful. And unless you realize this at the heart of it, at the heart of your first relationship or your fundamental or primary relationship or whatever it is, that unless you start inwards, you cannot do that outwards. You just cannot go out there and spread equality. You cannot spread social justice. You cannot be like a good minister. You cannot be unless you, this is part of your personhood. Which is why for him it was part of the same book about materialism, the same book about morality. It's also about love. So for me, it was like, you know, a lot of every commentator puts it at the end of the book. And but when I did the first translations, for me, it's like, I'm starting on love. Like, you sort this out to get everything else in order. So this is where I start. This is where I think the core of his message lies. So this is called Lessons from Gossip. Alar Arivurutal. So it's rumor sustains my precious life. Not many know this. We are indeed lucky. Unaware of the worth of my flower-eyed beloved, this village gifted me poisonous gossip. This rumor, this talk of the town, makes us feel we have got what we have not. Embroiled in scandal, sex gets a high, turns thrilling, else it loses its swag, its brag. Wine is a welcome joy when rejoicing. Public gossip heightens the pleasure of sex. We met just once, but rumor eclipses. Now we are a spectacle, a snake swallowing the moon. Manured by village rumors, watered by mother's words, this disease keeps growing. A scandal quenches desire the way ghee chokes a fire. My lover asked me not to be afraid, yet he left me a public scandal. How could these silly rumors in town ever put me to shame? Town clamoring is what we desire. Rumors will lead my lover to consent.
And just as my final question, one thing that becomes really clear while reading this is that, and maybe this is just a sort of a truism to say it, but that you're clearly bringing your poet's sensibility to this text. You're not sort of, you know, there's no sense of a sort of a literal word for word translation. There is, you know, with poetry, a poetry has to be translated by a poet. But we also, you have a collection of your own poetry coming out later this year, which we're all very excited about. And I'm just curious to know, could you reflect a little bit on, has the process of formally translating this had an impact on your own writing? Like, can you feel the dynamics? Have you been rewired by it slightly, or are they two quite separate projects for you?
I don't know how to answer that. I'm actually going to come into it another way. I think the only reason I could translate this text and translate it the way I translated, I've thought about it less as a poet and more as a woman in love. Like, if I have to tell the story of my life, like, what did I do? I fell in love a lot. I had my heart broken a lot. I fell in love again a lot, you know. So the fact that you've gone through these emotions, and these are really minute emotions, you know, it's not just some, you know, broad stratosphere of love there. And so the fact that you are living through it and you're living, I think that brings you a level of sensitivity. I couldn't do a medical text this way, you know. I couldn't do, even if I had the language for it, I couldn't do an economics text this way. But there's something that I could bring this granularity to it, obviously. And also being a poet, I'm sure, helped because, you know, I knew when to pause and when to stop. But also, I do think that Tirukural both is a guiding text, but also this translation does... help. One of the things is, sorry, Adam, the thing is, I think part of being a poet is you learn this absolute brevity. Mm-hmm. Like anything that's superfluous has to go so that what stays can, you know, be sharpened, you know,
yeah.
And you deliver something very forcefully, which actually is my biggest handicap as a fiction writer. And I think I've talked to you earlier about this, like how I suffer with every sentence because I'm not generous with my words. I really like, you know, whittle them down. So I do think that, you know, that's part of poetry. But then with the translations, I realized I had to be even more brief. Mm-hmm. Than even what I was given to being, because he is basically doing all of this in like 7 words, roughly. Uh-huh. and in English, like, I think the smallest kural was this one that says, quarrel, reconcile, make love. Mm-hmm. These the lover's rewards. So I tried around 8 or 10 words,
yeah.
But everything is around 25, 26. So, you know, it still is like, you know, but I tried to capture, that, you know, without adding anything to it. So it does teach me, I'm sure it does make me realize the necessity for saying less, but also not being ornate, you know, there's nothing that's ornate in this. Mm-hmm.
No. And it's such an extraordinary read. And I had to say to while reading it, that it will be, you know, it'll be read this year and years to come. Like I have the feeling it's going to become a staple in the, alongside perhaps Roland Barthes' Lovers Discourse, the kind of books that lovers exchange with each other. At certain moments in their relationship. Mina, that is all we've got time for. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Adam. Thank you so much for having me. Take care.
Thank you for listening to the Shakespeare and Company podcast. If you've enjoyed this conversation, it would be great if you could help us spread the word by reviewing or rating us in your favorite app, or just by sending the link to your friends. And don't forget, if you'd like even more from Shakespeare and Company, you can subscribe now through Apple Podcasts or Patreon for just €3 a month. Links to both are available in the show notes to this episode. Production of this podcast is all done in-house here at Shakespeare & Company Paris. All music is by Alex Fryman, whose album, Play It Gentle, is available to buy or stream wherever you listen. We'll be back soon. Until then, take care, and thanks again for listening.